Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, reel 16. So you went out to the Cameronians in Germany in July 1956.
Yeah.
What was the situation? Now, it's a long time since you've been with them in a way.
That's right.
You'd left them.
Well, I went back then. Unfortunately, I had to come down to corporal again. Because I was only an acting sergeant, and
did you mind that? That seemed a bit hard.
Well, it was a bit hard, but it was one of the things you had to accept. Like, you know, I felt within myself that I wouldn't have been down for long, but as I say, it affected your pay. However,
and where were they?
They were in a place called Buxter Hoodie,
B-U-X-T-E.
HUDE, Buxter Hoodie, something like that.
Where was Buxter Hoodie? Where's it near?
Buxter Hoodie was just about 20 miles or 30 miles south of Hamburg.
And you were joining the 1st Battalion?
The 1st Battalion, yeah.
And this was July 1956.
Yep. And the CO was another wonderful CO. Colonel Carter Campbell.
And what was he like? Cause I don't think we've talked about him.
He was he was a pre-war soldier, and he was an absolute gentleman. He used to like riding around his horse. He was a great horsey man. As a lot of the officers were in the regiment. But Duncan Carter Campbell was a type of chap. He would stop and talk to you in the barracks and ask you about how's your family and things like that. No, right out of the blue, you know. You'd be approaching him and fling him up a smart salute, and he'd give you a salute back and say, yes, come here, Clark, how are things and how are you getting on? And all that. Terrific chap. Now, the barracks we were in was a fantastic barracks. It was an ex-Luftwaffe barracks.
This is Buxter Hoodie barracks.
Buxter Hoodie barracks, yeah. Just in the outskirts of the town. Now, Buxter Hoodie itself was a little sort of market town.
Sorry, I interrupted. What were the barracks like? Tell us more.
Oh, they were pretty Rolls Royce compared to what we've been used to. They were built especially for the Luftwaffe before the war. And as you all know, Hitler was a great guy for making sure his armed forces were well housed in the best of conditions. So we were lucky. We had this lovely barracks, and we also had the terrific sports grounds. Within the confines of the barracks, football field, cricket pitch, hockey pitch, and even a swimming pool. So it was pretty Rolls Royce.
Now, had the unit changed much in your absence? You've been away.
Well, the thing was this: I've been away for quite a while, but it was just like coming back home again, virtually. Now, what happened was they put me in the training wing as a training NCO. And under Lieutenant Ian McBain.
What was your job as a training NCO?
Was just checking weapons, virtually. Go around the companies checking weapons to make sure everything was okay.
Now, how would you check them? What do you mean by checking weapons?
Well, you get into an Adams, a company Adams coat, and get a Bren gun down. Strip it down, just check everything was just been checked, it was maintained, it was good maintained, and you picked everything out at random, rifles out, two or three rifles at random, and if a weapon wasn't up to scratch, you took the number of that weapon and then you gave the number to the sergeant major, the company sergeant major. He was responsible for weapons and ammunition in the company, things like that. Or but I didn't get much to do then, because shortly after I got there I was sent to Hythe Small Arms School on a course, Hythe in Kent. So, as I say, I was only back in the battalion very, very short time until I was sent this course.
And what was the course?
This was a weapons course. Now, although they say it was a Small Arms course, it was virtually a method of instruction course. To go there, you had to know your weapons. You had to be very conversant with your weapons. And it's been known on many occasions, blokes were returned to the unit because they weren't efficient enough on weapons. Now, the instructors in this school were all guys who had one time or another had been in different regiments or corps, who had gone to Hythe, taken the course and excelled. And this is how they got them instructors. If you went to Hythe and got an A, then they were after you to get you back there. Now, they wore a special uniform. They wore the same battle dress as us, boots and gaiters, and a peaked cap with a special small arms school corps badge in it, like, you know. And my instructor was a little Scotch fella, I forget his name now. So I was a wee bit unlucky in this respect that I hadn't touched weapons for some time, really. But in those days, you kept your weapons in the barrack room. You know, we had Bren guns in the barrack room, you each had your rifle rack beside your bed. So what I was doing at night was really going to town practicing. You know, I mean, it's like learning to drive or learning to fly, you never forget it. And this is what happened to me. So, in effect, within a week, I was up to the standard that they wanted, like, you know. And I spent six weeks there.
And what were you learning? You were learning how to instruct.
Yeah, what you were learning to do was this. How to make a lesson plan. Now, the basis of all instruction is to have a plan. You plan your lesson by introducing the lesson. If it's a lesson in skills, demonstration, explanation, a complete demonstration, explanation. Just the rudiments of instruction. These instructors were brilliant in as much as they showed you how to lay your weapons out, how to place yourself so that your recruits would get the fullest view of what you were doing. And they taught us all sorts of little tricks of instruction that we never knew before.
What sort of thing?
Like, say, for example, split your squad in two. And one part of the squad checking. When you shout load, half the squad would be checking. You'd appoint them to look at a supervisor bloke, because obviously you as an instructor couldn't supervise a lot. So you used to get, it was a really terrific setup. And the whole thing was geared to making you a super instructor. And the good thing about it was that I managed to get my wife down for a couple of weeks. She came down and spent a couple of weeks here. We got in this lovely little bed and breakfast place. And that helped a lot. But as I say, the course was very, very effective. And I found it really gave me a lot of confidence in this course. And I finished up getting a B+. Which wasn't too bad.
So you only just missed the A?
I just missed the A, yeah. And there was one of the instructors there, was an ex-Cameronian, Big Fred Davey. Now, I met Fred just before he left. He went out to Wales with the Small Arms School Corps. They were doing some experimental work out in the coastal part of Wales. So I just managed to have a quick drink with Fred before he was sent out there on the detached duty. It was something to do with anti-tank weapons or something. If a weapon was being newly introduced to the army, and the boffins would come up with this weapon, the small arms school staff were responsible for doing the final checks and the final acceptance of these weapons that were so high powered. So, from that point of view, it was quite an interesting place to be, like, you know.
Now, can I ask you generally about new weapons? Because you must have had some new weapons come in from when you were first.
Exactly. What happened?
The rifle. I mean, hadn't the rifle changed by then?
The rifle had changed. What happened was, the course, I should have mentioned, the course was split into two. It was, the first part of the course was on the old Lee Enfield 303. Stand gun, things like that. But then in came the self-loading rifle.
Now, I want you to talk about that. What did you think of the Cyphaline in
Arkham? I detested it.
And how did it compare to the Lee Enfield? Tell me why.
Tell you why. The Lee Enfield rifle was a pretty solid rifle. Solid woodwork. With a good solid butt plate. And very accurate. And the thing about the Lee Enfield was there was a good feel about it. It was a solid feel. And everybody that used the Lee Enfield loved the weapon. It was so accurate, so easy to handle. Plus the fact it was an excellent weapon for drilling. But when I went on to this new weapon, the self-loading rifle as it was then, I was not impressed at all.
Then why not?
Simply because it didn't have the same solid feel about it. There was something very shallow about it, hollow about it. The woodwork itself was very hollow. The recoil was very bad, was very strong.
What, it hurt?
Yes. The recoil, I noticed later on when I started instructing on them, it put a lot of recruits off. The rear sight was prone to come back and hit the firer in the face, and this caused a lot of panic. And I must confess, I was never happy with it. The weapon's accuracy, I felt, was left a lot to be desired. So really and truly,
Was it meant to be better? How was it meant to be better than? In fact,
it was meant to fire more rounds. The spiel that we got was it was meant to have a greater rate of fire and be more accurate.
Now, what do you think of that?
I didn't believe that at all. In fact, I was surprised. Having, in actual fact, what I'm saying now contradicts what I've just said before, that these school corps guys approved of this. And I certainly didn't feel that. But the point is this.
Was it not faster, though? I mean, was it not a faster rifle?
Oh, it fired a lot more rounds in the rifle, but it was very, very prone to jamming. The rounds used to get clogged up, and this used to cause a bit of consternation among the people who fired it. So really, I wasn't very, very happy about it at all. And I think, in fairness to the small arms school guys, I don't think they realised that a young recruit coming off the street would have the same, it had a different effect on them. These instructors were trained men. They knew exactly what the weapon was about. But when you get a young recruit finding that the rear sight was hitting them in the face, it was quite demoralising.
But then, I mean, I know you said that to defend them, but on the other hand, you didn't like it either.
I didn't like it. No, it's definitely not. I didn't like it. And I've always been very... I don't know what the weapons are like now, or what later on in life, as the weapons probably got better. But I'm amazed that this weapon got through, because I certainly didn't like it. I felt terribly uncomfortable with it, you know?
Now, were there any other new weapons?
Yeah, the Sterling was the next one.
That's a submachine gun, isn't
it? Submachine gun, yeah, for close quarter battle. Now,
that was the replacement for the Sten.
For the Sten, that's
now, how did it differ? What was all bad about that?
The Sten gun, in effect, was just a piece of metal, virtually, with a barrel on it and a very, very simple trigger mechanism, firing mechanism. The Sterling came in and had a bit of woodwork about it. It was a bit more solid. When you think that the Sten gun only cost 15 shillings during the war and after the war to produce, whereas the Sterling was a much more expensive weapon. So it was the more up-to-date, elaborate things about it. It was a much more accurate weapon. It was easy to handle. I liked the Sterling.
Were there any other new weapons?
Not that I can remember.
Any new mortars or anti-tank guns?
No, everything just looks the same.
So, you passed the course with a B plus.
Got a B plus, yeah.
And then what happened when you went back? Did you go back to Buxtehude?
No, what happened was, while I was at the School of Infantry, I got a message to tell me that my next posting would be Edinburgh. The battalion had left for Edinburgh and were posted back to Edinburgh. So when my course was finished, I got on the train, and funnily enough, when I got on the train, there was the battalion rear party under the quartermaster on the same train as me.
So you've gone out to Buxtehude about July. In August, you've gone on the course.
That's right, right.
And now you were And where were you going in Edinburgh?
To Redford Barracks. The battalion was a...
Redford?
Redford, R-E-D-F-O-R-D, or Redford. Just an outskirts of Edinburgh, between Edinburgh and an area called Collington.
Now, were you pleased to get this posting back to Scotland?
Yes, I was, in actual fact, until something happened. But what happened was we went back to Redford Barracks. Now, Redford Barracks was a massive big barracks, held the whole battalion in the old buildings, like old barracks there. Now, there's a story behind this. Redford Barracks was very, very cold, very, very chilly, and the winds used to howl through it. And what had happened was, when the barracks was built away back in 17 or 18 something, the plan was that a barracks similar, or a barracks would be built in India. And what happened was, the plans got mixed up, partly. The Redford Barracks was built on the Indian style, and the vice versa. So in effect, that the soldiers in Scotland, in the Redford Barracks, were absolutely freezing to death, while the guys in India were absolutely sweltering to death. You know, so that was, it was very, although there was a, it was quite a big, decent barracks, it was so cold and uncomfortable. But the facilities weren't bad. We had the usual canteen, and access to Edinburgh was very good. We just come out the barrack gates, cross the road, and tram car and into Edinburgh. It was tram cars in those days, into Edinburgh. Or we could walk down to the village of Collington, and there's a nice big public pub there, the Collington Inn, which was frequented a lot by the military, because Drakehorn Camp was just up the road from there as well. However, what happened was, I was sent to, I think it was D Company, under Major Baines, John Baines, who's now Sir John Baines.
What was he like then?
Terrific bloke. Once again, of the old school, of the, he was very upper class, John, thorough gentleman. At this point, it's fair to say that all these chaps I've found from the upper echelons of life were absolute gentlemen, and then you, and I mean, they were trained to lead men. This was part of their life. The schools they used to get sent to were designed to make sure that they went to that, into the army, and knew how to handle men. And John Baines was of this ilk.
But were they hard enough to lead men?
Sorry?
Were they hard enough?
Yeah, they were very fit and hard men. Yeah, the steel was through them. You know, you couldn't, when the chips were down, They were leaders, all right. You know, you couldn't fault them in that way. Anyway.
Now, what were you doing in D Company? Were you still a corporal, or had you been gone back to
sergeant? No, I was a corporal. The climax will be coming shortly. We were just settling in. We just seemed to be settling in. It was actually going to be public duties, like, say, things in Edinburgh, you know, parades in Edinburgh, Edinburgh Castle Guards and what have you.
Can you tell us about that? What was an Edinburgh Castle Guard like?
I did one or two as a corporal and as guard commander. Now, Edinburgh Castle, doing the actual guard duties, you're quite removed from the public, funnily enough. The only person who was in contact with the public, where there's an actual sentry outside. When you as a guard commander, you just go out now and again and check that the sentry was all right. And other than that, you lived in the guard room and the entrance to the castle. But one funny incident did happen once. It was an evening time, and I had the sentry shouting, "Guard commander." So I went out and I switched up. He said, "There's somebody on the parapet wall there," he said, "trying to get over the parapet." I said, "You're joking." Because it was a bit nearly a sheer drop. So I got over there and there's this guy, the American sailor. "Hey, I want to see the Queen. I want to see Her Majesty the Queen." I said, "It's not the Queen you'll be seeing." I said, you'll be meeting the good Lord if you hang on there much longer." So I said, "Hang on there." And I got a couple of guards and we hold up, so I didn't want him to go back down. I could tell he had a drink in him. So I got the two of the guys to give me a hand up with him and we pulled him up over the parapet. And he had climbed up from the bottom right up to the parapet. Like, you know, and I thought, there's no way I'm going to allow that guy to go back down there. So when we got him onto terra firma, he said, "Right, see, I want to see your goddamn Queen. This is her house." I said, "No," I said, "you're sorry, Yank." I said, and he was starting to get stroppy. He was starting to, as if he was going to start throwing right-handers, like, you know. So I said, "Okay, you want to see the Queen?" He said, "Yes, I want to see the Queen." So I said, "Well, come with us." We took him out in the guard room and stuck him in a dungeon. There was a dungeon, there was a back door in the guard room that led down into dungeons. So we got him down the stairs, opened this door and flung him in this room, locked the door and back up into the guard room. And he was banging and crashing this door. So one of the men said to me, "So that's a dirty trick." I said, "No," I said, "it's not a dirty trick." I said, "That guy's at a stage," I said, "he can be either severely hurt or killed. Let him sleep it off there." And as sure as fate, the next morning, turned there, opened up, and he was lying there shivering. And I said, "You all right?" He said, "Yeah, goddamn," he said. "And I still didn't see the Queen, did I?" I said, "No, you didn't." So we got him out of it. And that was one of the funny incidents that happened, like, you know. But apart from that, it was all pretty straightforward. And there was a very famous man lived in there too, a bloke called the Pipe Major Willie Ross. Willie Ross was world renowned.
Then why was that?
He was the finest piper in the world, finest pipe major in the world. And he used to travel all over the globe giving demonstrations. He was, everywhere he went, he became an icon, you know. And the terrific bloke, he'd come in at night, he'd probably been down in Edinburgh, down in the Sergeant's Mess somewhere. And he'd stand and chat away to you, like, you know, wonderful guy. But apart from that, there wasn't anything doing. So the next thing...
Now, you weren't at Redford Barracks long, I believe, though, were you?
Oh, that's quite right. We were only there a very short time till the battalion was under 24-hour standby to fly out to Africa. I forget which country it was that there was trouble broke out. And the British, Britain was Britain's responsibility to send troops out there to this country to quell whatever trouble had blown up. So when I thought, no, I can't do this, I'll leave the army before I'll go back out there again. So I went and I saw, I think this was on a Wednesday. I went in and I got an interview with John Baines, Major Baines. And I explained to him, I said, "Look," I said, "I've just come back from abroad, sir." I've only been back a few months, I said, "and I don't think it'd be very fair for me to be sent back out again." He said, "You're quite right," he said. "I'll have a chat with the Colonel. I'll talk to the Colonel about it, this Colonel Carter Campbell again." So on the Thursday afternoon, the Colonel sent for me. He said, "I believe you don't want to go with the battalion." I said, "Well, it wouldn't be very fair, sir." I said, "When you look at my record," I said, "to find that I've just come back from, I haven't seen my wife for 3 years." And I said, "It wouldn't be very fair." And I said, "I must say that if I can't get out of this, then I'd like to leave the army." So he said, "Leave it with me," he said. "I'll have it sorted out within the next 2 hours." True to his word, the RSM sent for me and he said, "The Colonel wants to see you now, just march straight in, throw him a salute," like, you know. So, and he said, "Corporal Clark," he said, "I've had a good talk with Major Baines And he said, we do agree. He said, it would be unfair for you to be sent back out abroad so soon. So I said, what I've arranged to do, he said, tomorrow morning, he said, there'll be 1,500 wait to take you through to Lanark, the depot, and they'll find a job for you at Lanark for the next couple of years. How would that, that'd be fine, sir. So the next morning, go on the transport about 9 o'clock, through to Lanark, and I reported into the orderly room.
Now, this, according to this, it was sort of August 56. Now, that sounds a bit quick, because you seem to have only joined the Cameronians in Germany in July.
Well, that's right, yeah, but don't forget, I did this course at Hythe.
That's what I mean.
And then come back, and I was only back in the battalion a few weeks.
So you're only in Redford a couple of weeks.
That's right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so you went to Lanark in August.
That's right. So when I was reported into the orderly room, the ORQMS, the orderly room quartermaster sergeant, a bloke called Dixon, old Dickie, I said, you know my way here, sir? He said, aye. He said, you're improperly dressed. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you've been posted here as a sergeant. I said, no, I said, nobody told me that. Right, he said, go round to the tailor shop with your, he said, go and unpack your kit. He told me where to go. He said, unpack your kit and take your tunics round to the tailor shop. There's a little civvy tailor there. And he said, I'll meet you in the sergeant's mess for a pint at 12 o'clock. So that was it. And then he said, in the afternoon, he said, you come back, he said, and we'll tell you what's happening to you. So I duly did that. I got my third strike put up again, got myself sorted out a bit, went to lunch, had a drink, had lunch. And then at 2 o'clock, I went back to the orderly room with the ORQMS Dixon, and he said, right, he said, you've been posted here as an instructor. He said, you're going to be a squad sergeant. He said, there's a new squad coming in soon. And he said, you'll be taking it over. And that was my career reactivated again as an instructor at the depot.
Now, you've talked a bit about that. Did you carry on before? What was there any different? How did you react to being back as a squad?
I was delighted. I was absolutely delighted, because I always felt that this was my 40. This is what I was cut out to be an instructor, like, you know. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And especially as the guys were straight in from Civvy Street, it was quite an experience to see the various reactions of these guys. Because I was always a great one for... I've always been a great one for looking at the human element, how they react to things and that, you know. So anyway, I...
What do you mean? How did they react to coming in, you know?
Some guys just took to like duck to water. Other guys weren't all that good. That was the other thing. We had to watch them carefully to make sure that they were fit, even as national servicemen, to do their time. So if we saw any sort of weakness of a guy faltering, or a guy who was totally useless, couldn't pick a thing up, then you just go to the platoon commander and say, look, I think this guy's not going to make it. And then reports would be made out, and subsequently the guy would be kicked out of the army.
Would you monitor their progress closely? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I did, yeah. I used to love looking at them and seeing the reactions, like, you know. And
did most of them respond well to their training?
Oh, I thought very well. Those that got through it, you know, the initial few weeks, usually after the first month, you could tell who wasn't going to make it and who would make it. And I had nothing but admiration for these kids. They were really terrific, you know.